Okay, so these are my generated test cases. I'm ready to run them, so I go to the test view in Visual Studio. If you don't see this window, you will get it through the test menu, test, windows, test view, and you get this window here. I will select all the test cases that have been generated and say run selection, and I should get some errors there. Oh, this is my actual stopwatch running, so now you can see that it's not just exploring, but actually running the implementation. And that has, it has this form that shows the stopwatch on screen. Running, 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 and as you can see, some of the test cases have failed. This is actually an injected error. I hope so, at least. It might be a modeling error, too. So I can right-click one of these and say view test result details, and I see here the story. There are several mode buttons pressed, and then the result is wrong. Actually, this is an injected bug in the implementation. The stopwatch has here a comment saying, hey, there's a bug. This is how I find all my bugs. There's a comment saying this is a bug, right? And so they're very easy to fix. Now, what happens is there's a mode button, and if you push the mode button, it not only changes the display timer, but if it wasn't showing the timer, it will reset the stopwatch. So that's what fails. If I comment out this, now the bug is fixed. See how easy it is. If your developers tell you fixing a bug is hard, then you can prove it's not this way.
Magic of the Spec Explorer.
The magic of Spec Explorer. Okay. So this is the bug, and I don't need to regenerate my test cases. I just rerun them, right? Because I changed the implementation. I haven't changed the model. And I can even run only those that have failed. Those are the ones selected. I think I have a modeling error, though, because the injected error didn't produce so many errors before, I think. Apparently, I haven't. I don't have one. Okay. So now the test cases have passed. That's how you fix your software. See? All tests pass. Okay. So back to the slide deck. Actually, I think we're out of time. We don't have much time left. So I had a last slide that I can put up just in case, that shows a little bit how the test algorithm goes. So I'll leave it up here, but I'll answer any questions that you might have. I shouldn't have, I think, because now everyone's trying to read the algorithm. Don't read the algorithm. Yes?
I was interested in how you made a synchronous model. Because I've done it where you have the parallel syntax for running the parallel to make it synchronous.
Right.
So I assume that was something in the model where you were calling.
The question is very much to the point, and it's how did I manage my model to be synchronous, right? Let's go back to the model. So why is my model synchronous? What did I do to make it synchronous? Well, actually, all the actions in this model are call return actions. So if I go back to my configuration, you see none of these actions has the event keyword. And I think the next session we will have some events. But if you only have actions that are not event, sorry, call event actions that are not event, then your model will be synchronous by construction. So it will just call the the action and expect a return from the action and do nothing in between. So in this intermediate states, let me see the... No, this is the test cases, sorry. My model... You see there, yes. So in this, in these intermediate states, in the diamond state, the Spec Explorer will not enable any action but the return to the call that got it there. That's how it works. So as long as you keep your model down to actions that are not events, that are call returns, then it will be synchronous. When you add events, that might turn it into an asynchronous model. But it doesn't need to, because in your rules, you can guarantee that each time you receive a stimulus, the only enabled action is its corresponding response, and that will result in a model that will look very much like this. So you send a stimulus and only receive one response. But that will be up to you if you have events. Usually, most of the time you introduce events because you don't want your model to be asynchronous. So you want to have a stimulus that results in many things happening in the model or in the implementation, or results in nothing happening in the implementation, and so on. And you would have some stimulus that don't have a response. Another question, yes?
So in your model, you had this method that returns a Boolean, which formed the basis of your validation completely. So it was being called to validate your test cases pass and things like that. But oftentimes, we may have a system where we may have to do more validation than as simple as a Boolean check. It could be that I do this action, after this I need to, there's business logic that's getting executed by calling this particular method. So I may have to verify a whole lot of other things than just the Boolean. So where do you insert your validation logic then?
The question is, I'll try to summarize it. So the question is, in this model, the Oracle, the checks that the implementation was actually doing, what we expected, was performed by an action that returned a Boolean. Just asked a question to the implementation and returned a Boolean. What if the check that I want to perform is much more complex, not just true or false, right? Well, the answer is not that much difference. So the shortest answer is you still need to somehow ask the implementation. Usually it's through a question like the one I'm asking here. It could be also through an event that you will expect. But I could ask this question, is timer reset, let's say, and instead of receiving a Boolean, I could receive a very complex data structure, like a struct, for example, that tells me which the information that I need to know. There is no validation logic in Spec Explorer besides the traces that we test. So the validation logic is I send stimulus and I receive responses. The responses are not necessarily just a name. They can be very complex. For example, I can say I expect, and we will see it in the following lessons, but I can say I expect back from the model an event that will contain the whole structure of the file system, right? And that will be the parameter to an event or the return value. But there is no validation logic besides the fact that the traces are the ones that were expected. The implementation can perform the same actions as the model in the same order and with the same parameters and return values. So all the validation logic is contained in the model. When I say what are the valid values for a return value or the valid values for the parameters of an event, that's where I'm setting the logic that the test cases will validate. Now, does that answer your question? You can also, yes, Wolfgang has a good point. Besides return values, you could have out parameters. So if you want, instead of returning a single structure, you could return several out parameters from the implementation to the model with the information that you want.
And then you would write the validation for the out parameter. parameters in the model itself?
The question is, in that case, would you write the validation for the out parameters? Yes. In the same way that I set here return, I would set the values for the out parameters if I know exactly what they should be. And I can write predicates for them if I don't know exactly what they should be. I don't think we'll be showing. We will be showing out parameters in some of the next classes.
So I just want to expand on that question.
Yes.
The fact that you had a rule like this with a bool that had no conditions meant that that rule essentially was invocable at any point during any exploration.
Yes.
Right. So essentially, you added a de facto validation all over the place by having that. Is that correct?
So the question is, by adding this rule here that has no enabling condition, I'm adding a de facto check to every state. That's true, and it's in the model, right? Now, we consider it to be a validation because it has a return value. It could be something like, for example, I have one here. I have one here that is not a validation, but it's enabled in every state, and it changes the state. It's not a loop, right? So
the pattern to which Peter has referred to really exists, and it's a loop which is basically enabled in every state, an action which has an output or return parameter, and it's enabled in every state, and it's just looping, doesn't change the state. Right. That's like a validation action. And so it can expose, in theory, the full state of the model, or compare whatever you want from the model state to the implementation state.
So I could essentially, that's sort of expanding on your question. In other words, if I had some very complex state validation, I could just make that appear everywhere in the model by doing something like this.
The question is, if I would have a very complex state validation, I could add one of these actions. We call them checker actions, by the way. There's a checker pattern that is part of the Spec Explorer help in the MSDN library. I could add one of these actions that loop in every state and return a value that can be as complex as we want. Yes, the other thing you can do is you can pass parameters here, so your adapter could perform the validation too, because the adapter will get information from the model before performing the validation. All this is explained in the help.
Can you have multiple checker actions in each state if you want to split your validation?
The question is, can I have multiple checker actions in every state? And yes, you can have them. And they don't need to be in every state, too. So if I want to just check those, for example, let's say I don't care whether the timer is reset when I'm showing the time, then I would just set the condition here to the same as here, right? It's only if it's displaying the timer, so you don't need to check every state. Your checker can appear in the places where you want to check it. Yes?
But really, you don't need those very often, right? Because the state is driving the model expiration, and so...
The comment is, you don't really need them in all models, because the model of the implementation, which the state of the implementation of the system and the test, which you don't know because it's a black box, it's driving the system, whereas your model, which you do know, has a state that is driving the traces. And what you want to compare is both sets of traces, the traces generated by the model and the traces generated by the implementation. That is very true, but sometimes there are things in an intermediate state that are not exposed by the traces themselves, and you want to somehow check whether you can match the state in the implementation to something you know in the model. For that, of course, you need testability on the implementation side. So most implementations don't have a way, unless one has created it, in order to be tested for its state to be tested. Usually they don't have a way to ask, hey, can I see what your database is? No, you can't. My database is mine. What you can do is you can just put something in your shopping cart. but there's no way you can access my database. Well, I can put something on my shopping cart and then go to the page where I see the contents of my shopping cart, and in that way I can find out what the price is. And I can do that for every possible product that I know about, and then I'll get a very detailed knowledge at least of your prices, right? Of your price list. But still, I cannot see what the state is, and I have no idea what the database of a company that I'm shopping has.
I think for this example we have seen, it's very typical for UI, because actually the person who is validating is a user, because the user sees the time on the display. No? So that's why if you have testing a UI, you will most of the time have this kind of checkers. You will need them, because there is no API to verify what is displayed to the user.
Wolfgang's comment is that in this case we're testing a UI, and in UI testing it's very common that we want to observe the state of the UI to make sure that it's showing what we think it should be showing. That could be done by really somehow observing the contents of a window, or by invoking an API that will let us know what the contents are.
What would be the point of passing parameters to the checker?
The question Peter is asking is, what would be the point of passing parameters to the checker? So let's say that we want to check, for example, the number of items in a database, right? I would like my adapter to do the check. I won't check it in the model. I will let the adapter to turn this call into a query, then extract the number from the query and compare it to what I have in my model state. So I could pass here a parameter, and through a condition I could set that parameter to be the same value as I have in my model at that point. Now that would result in the adapter getting the information that I wanted to get and being able to do the comparison, for example, and return a boolean. That could be one example.
But doesn't the rule have access to all the state? What could you possibly pass that it doesn't have access to?
The rule, so the adapter only has access, I'm testing now, so the adapter only has access to parameters to the rule. So the rule has access to the state. It doesn't have access to the implementation. Now I need someone who has access both to the state or to some aspects of the state and to the implementation. And that someone is the adapter.
Oh, because it's calling the underlying implementation function by the same name.
Exactly. Well, this is calling, what I'm calling here when I generate the test case is the adapter method that has the same name as my action. Now the adapter is doing something to the implementation. We have no idea what it's doing. Maybe it's sending a SQL query, actually. So it's an SQL query that will result in some values that need to be somehow compared, and the comparison could be complex too. Maybe there's some marshalling to do or whatever, and I'm telling the adapter, okay, this is what I think the state should be at this point. Please check if that's the case.
My confusion was that a checker was only run within the context of a model and didn't actually touch the implementation. You're saying it does.
The question is the checker only run in the context of the model, or does it somehow touch the implementation? Well, during exploration, it's only explored in the model, and it results in this, I'll show the other picture, in these loops. So that's during model exploration. Then during test case construction, it's turned into steps in a test case that have the expected return value. Then when I generate code, this will result in calling actually a method by this name, is timer reset, on the implementation or on the adapter, same as the rest of the actions. And in this case, I could be, by calling this method, I could be providing information about my model state or expected model state to my adapter. I see what your point was. Yeah, very good point. Any other questions? Well, oh, we have more one.
I just, I'm curious. Can you go back to the model
exploration?
No, the model CS.
Yeah.
Can you just give examples of some syntax there for your rule where read lap button would be different than the signature of the method there?
Sure. Well, in this case, I have no parameters. But let's say that the reset lap button has a parameter telling it whether it should do actually a reset or a lap, right? So for that we would have somewhere a type. Let's go to the to config that chord here, right? Or let's say it's Boolean, saying it's reset. True means reset, right? So now the reset lap button would say bool is reset, right? Now, when I go back to my model, it turns out that what I need to do is very different in both cases, right? If it's true or if it's false. The behavior is really different because in one case it's doing the reset and in the other case it's doing the lap. So I could say I have two rules for this action. One is the start-stop button. It's the reset, right? So one is, they are not called reset lap button. One is reset button. And the other one is lap button. And for the reset button, this action, rule should only be triggered, should mean that I'm passing true here, right? So I can write true, and then I write the whole thing. The action is still void, but now I don't need an if here and so on because it's changed. And then I write the other rule. And the result that I would get, that I would get is pretty much what I expected, as if I had an if in here. But now I'm partitioning my work. It's a separation of concerns. Since these are two different behaviors, very different, I have two rules with the same action. So see how the name of the rule is reset button, and the name of the action is reset lap button. And reset button has no parameters as a rule, but the action does have one parameter. It's true in one case and false in the other. Okay, so thank you very much. And I guess we'll see you here tomorrow for the third and fourth sessions of this class. Thanks.